Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Divorce rates have risen around the world in recent decades. The process is tough on the broken couple, of course, but when children are involved, the impacts can be long-lasting. Nearly half of American children live in divorced single-parent homes by age 16 these days. We're talking about divorce, how the legal process has changed, but how the effect on children stays the same if it goes unchecked. Joining us by phone to talk about the children is licensed clinical social worker, psychotherapist, and lecturer at Northeastern University in Boston, Amy Morin. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
When we say some kids rebound faster than others, what does that mean?
So when they do studies to examine how kids are doing in terms of their mental well-being, if they're experiencing anxiety, depression, behavioral problems, some kids, it seems to get better for most kids within about 2 years. But some kids, it just seems to linger, and sometimes it lasts well into adulthood.
You know, this is anecdotal just from my personal experience being alive in the 20th century, but it seems like the kids who act out at the time of the divorce or soon after, they seem to adjust better long term. It's the quiet ones who seem to be taking everything, you know, well, that are struggling.
Yeah, I think that is true in many cases, and it often depends on how much support kids get. So kids who act out maybe tend to get more support because the adults recognize this kid is struggling, this kid needs a little more help. And we come in and we give them that. We give them those resources. Whereas the quiet kid who sits in the back of the room and doesn't really disrupt class or doesn't make much of a fuss, I think sometimes adults assume that kid's doing okay, they don't need much, maybe this really didn't affect them, but we don't know what's going on the inside.
Is it any much at all a predictor? We're going to be talking about collaborative divorce later on in the program, but I'm wondering if it's any at all a predictor. If parents try to get along during the divorce, does that necessarily help?
That does. That's the number one predictor. Most studies will show that divorce in itself isn't necessarily difficult for kids. It's how their parents get along that makes all the difference. So in high conflict divorces where the kids end up in the middle of custody disputes that sometimes last for years and the parents are talking poorly about one another and kids feel like they're stuck in the middle, those are the kids that are much more likely to have long-term effects from it.
Mm-hmm. Does the age range matter?
It can, because little kids don't understand it as much. If you have a preschooler, then the adjustment can be difficult, but then they sort of get used to it, as compared to if you have an older kid who figures out exactly what that's going to mean, that maybe mom and dad aren't both going to be at your baseball games or that you can't sit around and have dinner like a family ever again. So it can affect kids quite differently depending on their age. And sometimes sex matters too. We know that gender can play a role, that girls sometimes internalize things, whereas boys are more likely to externalize it and act out when they're struggling.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about divorce today. If you have a question or comment for my guest, Amy Morin, she's a licensed clinical social worker and psychotherapist and knows a lot about how children react to divorces, short-term and long-term, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'd like to hear from people who are children of divorced parents and, you know, how you coped and what you think are the long-term effects of it on you, or maybe how you were able to overcome the struggles at some point in your life. 614-292-8513. Gender, what about only children versus lots of kids in a family kind of a thing?
Yeah, that can definitely play a role, too. When you have an only child, sometimes, some situations it's helpful because they get doted on by both parents. Mm-hmm. And both parents sort of come in and become really supportive. But in a family where there's a lot of kids, kids can sometimes get lost in the shuffle. But on the other hand, they also have their siblings who understand what it's like. So sometimes I've seen in my therapy office kids who kind of come together and support one another. And, yeah, this is really hard. Or, yeah, we have to pack to go to dad's house for the weekend. And it gives them somebody to bounce those ideas off of because parents often just don't get some of the struggles that kids have. Like, I forgot my homework at dad's house or my soccer cleats are at mom's and now I don't know what to do. But when you have siblings who can talk about that stuff, then it can just be helpful to sort of normalize, boy, I'm kind of sad we're not going to be here tonight because we have to go to the other house. So sometimes they come together like a support team, which is wonderful. And then, of course, if parents get remarried and we introduce step-siblings, that's sort of another whole layer of complicating factors.
You know, 40 or 50 years ago, divorce was still very stigmatized. You know, in some communities, you might be the only kid whose parents were divorced. And that's not the case anymore. You know, I've seen in your writings, I've seen you refer to that 49%, 48% of American and British kids are from divorced families by the time they're age 16. Does the lack of stigmatization, the normalcy of it, does that help at all?
I think so. I think it's for kids especially to know that that they understand. So if a child says, do you want to come over to my house this weekend? And the kid has to say, well, gee, I'm going to be at my dad's house, not my mom's. Then there's nothing thought of it, or that other parents get it, that if you're inviting kids to a birthday party, you have to know where the kids are going to be on any given weekend, or that if it's a single mom raising children and the dad's not in the home, other parents seem to kind of rally around and understand what that means. Whereas years ago, kids didn't get that. It was like it was an embarrassment, I think, or that the rest of the families just didn't understand some of the complicating factors that come about from custody issues and raising kids as a single parent.
Yeah, the custody thing, how does that affect kids?
You know, some kids do adjust quite well, depending on the schedule. Sometimes we see judges in family courts who really make complicated schedules. So I think it usually works best when kids are primarily in the same home on school days and then maybe the other home on the weekends, or if they have some sort of a set schedule. Mm-hmm. But I've seen some cases where it's 10 days at mom's house, 10 days at dad's house, or 5 days here and 5 days there. And so kids struggle to get into a routine because sometimes it's a school night, sometimes it's a weekend. And when the rules at both houses are very different, there's different schedules, different expectations, things get really complicated for kids, and I see a lot of them who struggle over the course of years just because they're never able to say, oh, on Monday nights, I'm always at dad's house. And they have to look at a calendar. If a friend says, do you want to go to my birthday party on the 16th? They don't know on a Friday night whether they're at mom's or dad's, and they have to get out the calendar and kind of count the days, and it just gets really, really complicated.
Yeah, it sounds like being a grown-up. Who wants to do that? You
know? Right, when you're 8 years old. You just don't want to have to worry about those things. So I think it works best when parents work out a schedule and that they can be flexible to know, well, if soccer practice is on Friday night, even though my parenting time starts at 4 p.m., I'm going to make sure that my child makes it to soccer practice. And when both parents can support the child's activities and make sure that the kids still get to do things on the weekends that maybe were planned on a Wednesday, then it works out much better.
Sometimes, you know, ideally, the parents should agree and have sort of similar approaches to child rearing, but sometimes the child rearing is part of what broke them up in the first place. Not to blame the children either. I mean, they just have very different ideas about how children should be raised. How do you hear that from children, that they like it that they have more privileges at one house over the other, or that there are more chores to do at one or the other, or anything like that?
Yeah, for a lot of kids, they come to that conclusion. They just sort of have accepted, oh, okay, at mom's house we get to stay up late, at dad's house there's a strict bedtime, or in one house we have to eat healthy and we don't have to in the other house. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just a few things kids are able to usually make that adjustment. But when you have one parent who tends to be much stricter across the board and the other parent is way more on the permissive end, it can be really hard for kids to make that adjustment. And so for some of them, it'll take 2 or 3 days to get back into the routine of that parent's home. And then by the time they get into that routine, it's time to switch to the other home. And that can be quite taxing on kids. I don't know how many families I worked with over the years where the kid was brought into therapy because parents would say there's something wrong with the kid, or the kid's not adjusting well, or having these certain behavior problems. Mm-hmm. But really, it was just a matter of trying to convince both parents to get a little bit on the same page when it came to certain issues that were affecting the child. Because in these really high conflict divorces where parents have completely different ideas on parenting, they just sort of want to point fingers and blame the other person, and nobody wants to make any adjustments to their own schedule. And that's really tough on kids.
You know, we know that demonizing the other parent to the children is not good. Does it matter if it's done when children are older, when the divorce takes place, when they're in late teens or, you know, in adults almost?
Older kids will come to their own conclusion at some point, because I'll have sometimes the parents will say, well, I'm not demonizing the other parent. This is true. And maybe the other parent has a substance abuse issue, or the other parent only shows up occasionally for visits, that sort of a thing. But it's always best to say, you know, how am I going to let my child sort of figure this out on their own? And that doesn't mean you can't have conversations that say sometimes the other parent makes some poor choices, or I'm sorry that mom doesn't always show up for Friday night visits. But at the same time, when you have little kids, I see so many parents who will try to tell them, well, I would have let you go to soccer practice on Saturday, but dad said no, so it's dad's fault.
Mm-hmm.
And just those little comments after a while take a toll, and sometimes that backfires, because then kids end up becoming, they trust the other parent more. So the one who's being demonized, in the end, it tends to backfire on parents, that kids tend to align with the other parent as they grow older.
Why is that?
I think kids just get sick of hearing it, or they get tired of, or they start to see some inconsistencies.
Okay.
Because when a parent is demonized, it's usually exaggerated, over the top, it's constant. And then kids will see some inconsistencies, like, no, dad isn't terrible all the time. He did something nice for me. And so then they just start to think, well, maybe dad's the sane one in this situation, and they align more with dad than they do with mom, or vice versa.
Well, you know, which kind of brings up the whole issue of, the kids aren't stupid.
Right.
They're just people.
Right.
I mean, I try to imagine what would it be like as an adult to go back and forth between households and play by someone else's rules.
Exactly. How disorienting if sometimes on a work night you were at a different house than you are on certain nights, and you didn't have any say on when those nights happened.
Yeah.
And I worked with, I think, two families over the past 15 years who had a house that was for the kids.
Yeah.
And the parents swapped places. And what a difference that was.
Does it make a big difference?
It does, for kids to be able to sleep in the same bed every night, as opposed to having to go back and forth or out of town or anything like that. Just gave them a lot more structure and consistency, and their friends knew where to find them and how to get a hold of them. And seemed to be really good for the kids when parents, obviously most parents aren't in the situation where you're able to do that financially. Or
exactly. That's what I was going to bring up. I mean, the people I know who have done that are people of means. You know, I was reading to prepare for this that most people reduce their assets by an average of something like 77% because of divorce.
Yes.
Wow.
And sometimes that's sort of the bigger toll that divorce takes on kids. It's not necessarily not having mom and dad under the same roof anymore. It's that the fallout of divorce affects them a lot when they have to move, because nobody can afford a house, so both parents are renting apartments, and kids are struggling more. They don't have a car. They can't do all the sports and other activities they used to do. That's a big change. So it's not just not having both parents in the same house that really affects kids, but sometimes it's that. And then when parents are stressed out about money, that has a trickle-down effect to kids as well, because they feel the stress too.
And then the single-parent household, a lot of cases still is just one parent pretty much towing most of the load. They're mostly taking care of the kids. They're also working, usually, and they have a lot more pressure. That's the one the kids are with.
Exactly. And so then when that parent is under a lot of pressure, kids feel that too. They know, okay, mom or dad is really stressed out. Mom or dad has to work all the time now, whereas maybe they didn't have to work that many hours, and I don't have anybody to drive me to basketball practice, or my parent can't take my friends and I to the movies anymore because they're always working. And so it's all of those sorts of things that definitely take a toll, and that's part of the aftermath of divorce. And so we know that couples who have higher financial means, more stability with their employment, kids tend to do better in those situations after divorce anyway, just because they don't have to deal with all of those extra problems associated with their parents splitting up.
And you know, the thing is it's not because they're spoiled or anything. It's just they're allowed to just be kids and go on with their life.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of kids where the older sibling sort of becomes the babysitter, or they have to take on a lot more chores. And those things aren't necessarily bad when you help kids become more responsible, but you also don't want kids to have to take on a lot of adult problems so that they can't just enjoy childhood and have fun without worrying about, do we have enough money for this, or is mom going to be able to to be awake enough to help us do this because she works so many hours. And that's when it becomes a problem for kids, especially with older siblings.
We are talking about divorce today. Almost half of marriages in the United States end up in divorce. My guest is Amy Morin. She's a licensed clinical social worker, a psychotherapist, and a lecturer at Northeastern University in Boston. Coming up, we're going to hear from a mental health counselor who is the neutral party in collaborative divorces in Columbus. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about how divorce has changed over the years and how it affects families and their children. Still with us by phone, licensed clinical social worker, psychotherapist, and lecturer at Northeastern University in Boston, Amy Morin. And joining us now, mental health counselor, family relations specialist, and divorce coach, Randy Cohen. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Yeah, Randy participated in a program we did a few years ago on collaborative divorce, and I think we should post a link to that show on our website at WOSU.org/allsides, because that was a very popular show. Every time we aired it, we would get lots of feedback from listeners. So, Randy, it's a thing. You're still in the business, I take it.
Still in the business. That's all I do now,
yeah,
actually. Yep.
Right. If someone with a child is considering divorce, they contact you seeking advice, where does the kid come into the conversation?
Well, for me, that's kind of the big picture is what's in the best interest of these kids. So then I start talking with the parents initially. Either they're sent to me by attorneys or they find me, and then I give them a short list of attorneys or send them to our website, the Collaborative Divorce website. And it's about the kids. It has to be about the kids, because if couples are going to end a marriage and they don't have children, they can just walk away. They don't have to ever interact again. But, I mean, as Amy was talking about, this is really impactful for the kids. So,
Amy, are you familiar with the collaborative divorce movement?
Yes, definitely. It's wonderful when parents can work together like that.
I guess when they seek a collaborative divorce, that means they're kind of open to making things better at the outset, right?
Well, it yeah. means that they come in saying they're open to that. That does not mean that they come in singing kumbaya.
Yeah.
I mean, there's really a lot of contention, and I don't think I've ever had a case where the couples come in and say, we're both in agreement and we both came to the same conclusion at the same time, and neither one of us feels like we're the one who's being left. There's always somebody who has initiated and somebody who feels like they didn't
someone
have a choice.
Someone who's a perpetrator and someone who's a victim, or they
right.
feel that way.
Right, right.
Yeah. Does that square with you, Amy Morin? There's always this kind of dynamic in it?
There usually is. And I think, and I don't think that that's necessarily a terrible thing. I guess I've worked with a couple of families over the years where the parents got along really well. Even when they were married, they got along well, and they never seemed to have any fights. So then the kids were just really confused because they, A, never saw the divorce coming. It was a complete shock to them. But then their parents just got along so well afterward, they just didn't understand because nothing ever seemed like it was different. And so it was so confusing for the kids to think, well, why can't mom and dad be together if they still seem like they're best friends and things are going well? So I think for kids to know, divorce is messy, it can be painful, and we don't get along, or here's the reasons why, isn't always a bad thing.
Hmm. Some of the things that you just said, Amy, I think really strike a chord, because the not arguing is, I mean, we have couples who come in and say, we've never argued. And,
right.
And they say that pridefully.
Which is a red flag.
And now they're talking divorce. Right.
So. But it's interesting. You think there's not that kind of conflict and that strife. The child's not exposed to that, Amy Morin, but it backfires.
Yeah, you certainly don't want kids, you know, we know that sometimes in high conflict marriages, kids experience this sense of relief when parents announce that they're getting divorced because they think, great, I don't have to listen to them yelling and screaming. But on the other hand, when kids think that mom or dad are fine and this is what a marriage is like and they have no idea that there's any trouble at all, that can be just so jarring to them. And so to find that happy ground where kids know mom and dad don't always get along and that there are problems and that they're working things out and maybe they do it quietly, but everything isn't hunky-dory all the time. And then, of course, it depends how they get along with afterward, and we always want parents to get along well. But I've also seen in some cases where some parents don't want the kids to have to really experience the aftermath of divorce. So parents, after being divorced, will say, well, we'll still spend holidays together like a family, and we'll still do everything together. We still will go on family vacations together. And the kids are thinking, what on earth is going on here? Mm-hmm. And it's wonderful that the parents want to do that, but at the same time, there needs to be a little bit of separation so kids have the opportunity to grieve.
Interesting. I hadn't thought of that. It's confusing, and there's no final settlement. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about divorce today. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513. You just heard from Amy Morin. She's a licensed clinical social worker, a psychotherapist, and a lecturer at Northeastern University in Boston. She's written a lot about the impact on children when it comes to divorce. Also with us, Randy Cohen. She's a mental health counselor as well and a collaborative divorce neutral. That means she's that person in the room when people decide to go the route of a collaborative of divorce. It's an actual thing. She helps keep them on focused on what they're trying to achieve and keeps them from veering maybe off into the wilderness. Does something like, say, philandering people have play any kind of different kind of role in all of this, Randy Cohen? If someone has had an affair, does that change the dynamic at all?
I don't know that it certainly plays a part. It's a huge part in the dynamic. I don't know that it changes. There's still betrayal, hurt, whether it's another person or they left the marriage for the job or whatever. They just mm-hmm. mentally checked out. For 20 years, I worked with couples helping them stay together. And actually, working with couples to stay together after an affair, they come out much stronger because they're both committed to doing it. So the affair itself doesn't create the reason for divorce. You know, I think mm-hmm. that when couples come in, they're hurt. They're at the worst they can be. And as professionals, we have to remember that regardless of the role we play, the attorneys have to remember it. And these attorneys are specially trained to be non-aggressive and to be collaborative. So it's really nice to work with attorneys who really care about the impact on the family. It's my job to remind them that even though somebody may be acting like a jerk, it's because they're very hurt. I mean, they're both hurt. Even if it's the person who says, I want to end the marriage, there's still a lot of hurt inside.
Amy Morin, should children know if there's been betrayal? Well, we've already talked about how parents and the damage it can be done when you demonize the other parent, no matter how much it might be, quote unquote, their fault. But you keep it secret. Kids find out another way. What's the best way to reveal when it comes to that?
I think it depends on a number of factors, such as the age of the child and then how parents have dealt with that. I've had some parents who've come to the conclusion, okay, we won't tell the child because maybe he's only 5 years old, so he's not going to understand anyway. But then the parent who feels betrayed can't help but throw that in there sometimes because they're resentful. So they'll make these comments like, well, just wait until someday when you understand what your mother actually did. And And, you know, and then it ends up sort of becoming this whole new toxic thing as the child's growing up to wonder what this big secret is, or that kids end up figuring it out on their own. So I think it really depends on the situation, if parents are able to heal from it and move forward, or if somebody's holding this huge thing of resentment and you just can't get rid of it and they end up making these snide comments to kids, then it becomes really unhealthy. So I think it's all about a case-by-case basis. And for sometimes parents, just to sit down and be honest with kids and say, you know, I messed up, and here's the mistake that I made, and this is what happened, and it really hurt your mother, it hurt your father. And in some of those cases, that's really good for kids to hear it directly so that they don't end up hearing it from somebody else.
Mm-hmm. Randy Cohen, is when it comes to revealing to children stuff like that, whatever it might be that caused it, some kind of betrayal, maybe it's an addiction, maybe it's an affair, you know, regardless, when you're in a collaborative divorce, is that something that you decide together, okay, this is how we're going to talk about this with the children?
Well, that certainly is one of the conversations we have, is what is the story you're going to share with the public? Because each person also has their own truth, their own version of what happened. And so I think it's important for some couples to get on the same page so that they can share with the families, share with the neighbors, share with whomever what's really going on here. Why are we ending the marriage? You know, let all the neighbors know instead of each person telling their own version. And that's very powerful, actually, because if it's consistent, both people feel they learn to trust each other's words during this process. Because if they're really both honoring that story, and that's the story they're giving to everybody or whoever they decide to give it to, I think that's a really powerful impact that moving forward, that you can trust my words. I committed to this and I'm doing it.
We have a comment from Wendy on Facebook. She says, I just want to say that marriage and divorce are not binary. Marriage is good and divorce is bad. It is proven that living in a high conflict home is more traumatic than coping with a divorce. While not minimizing the effect on children, seeing what healthy relationships are and not dealing with constant conflict or abuse is an important plus for some divorces. My great grandparents never divorced. My grandmother has no happy memories of her childhood, and her mother suffered horrific abuse.
Wow.
Kids deserve to feel safe, and sometimes divorce is needed for that to happen.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things I talk a lot about with the couple is that what children see, they learn what they see modeled. So it's really important for the parents to remember that how they behave and what they say and what they do, kids will learn. And so trying to remember that being your best is a gift to your children.
It resonates, Amy?
Yeah, absolutely. I've seen some parents who really thought, oh, goodness, we have to sit down with our child and explain divorce, and the child's going to be so upset. And the kids were actually relieved.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, thank goodness, just for those reasons that were mentioned, because, you know, when they're fighting and they're screaming and all of this discord, for a lot of kids, it's a relief to think, okay, that's going to end now.
Mm-hmm. There's a movie, a documentary, and I think there's now two of them. It's called Split, and Ellen Bruno was the woman who did the research, and the first movie, Split, was a movie for children of divorce, by children of divorce. The only people in the movie are the children, and they're talking about divorce in the impact, and it's heart-wrenching, and it's really funny, and it's sweet, and it's all of these things that kids report out. And then she then followed up 10 years later with these same kids. And so there is a website called splitfilm.org where you can actually,
Were they in the 10 years later?
I haven't seen that
okay.
one. I really want to see that one.
Brandy in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Brandy.
Hi, this is great. What a wonderful opportunity to be able to talk about the experience that my ex and I had with Randy. Randy, it's Brandy. I don't know if you remember me. It's
Hi, Brandy.
Hi. I mean, I can't really speak highly enough about that process.
Why was it great to you?
Well, you know, one particular piece was that I had chosen to leave, and I had to because I had to come out and live the right life for myself. I came out as somebody who shouldn't be married to a man and who should have been married to a woman, and I wouldn't have been able to do that, you know, without leaving the relationship. And with that came just a huge amount of guilt. But it was through working with not only Randy, but Susan, our financial person, they helped me to gain a lot of perspective and put the guilt aside and advocate for myself as needed. You know, they really positioned themselves in a spot that is trying to advocate for both sides, both parties fairly, you know, as fairly as possible. And I was really ready to sacrifice a lot financially. And it was Susan's intervention and my lawyer's intervention that said, you know, you probably need to actually change this figure financially and ask for that. And fortunately, my ex was really reasonable and responded well to that. So that advocacy was just absolutely invaluable.
Hmm. Brandy, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Take care. There's another twist that we haven't brought up yet. Amy Morin, you know, what Brandy went through, you know, manifesting her true self and having to go through a divorce in the process of that, is that becoming more of a thing in this day and age?
It is. I've seen it quite a bit. And I think parents are really concerned. A lot of them are about how's this also going to affect my child? And I think that when parents are comfortable in saying, okay, I'm gay or I need to be in a different sort of relationship, kids can be quite resilient to that. And it's not nearly as big of a deal most of the time as parents think it's going to be, as long as depending on how they approach it and how they talk to kids and how the whole thing comes about, you know, after the divorce and with any type of relationship, no matter what kind you get into after being divorced, you'd want to make sure that you do it slowly, you give your child time to grieve, and then kids, most of the time, they could care less whether you end up in a same-sex relationship or a different kind of relationship than you were before, as long as it's healthy and it's done in a healthy way for the kids.
I think it also reinforces that to the kids that they can trust their parents' words, that they're being very real, they're being authentic, they're being, so what I say, you know, my word is my bond here. Mm-hmm. So,
big thing. Amy Morin, we have to say goodbye to you. I appreciate your time so much today.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Amy Morin, licensed clinical social worker, psychotherapist, and lecturer at Northeastern University in Boston. Randy Cohen, mental health counselor and a collaborative divorce neutral, is going to stay with us as we consider and continue our conversation about divorce 2018 style. I got to get caught up on my years. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about how divorce has changed over the years and how it affects families and children. Still with us is mental health counselor and collaborative divorce neutral, Randy Cohen. Joining us by phone is professor of family and consumer studies at the University of Utah and author of the book Understanding the Divorce Cycle, The Children of Divorce in Their Own Marriages, Nicholas Wolfinger. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
So you've studied how children of divorce deal with their own marriages. What's the big takeaway from that? I mean, what are the factors we should be thinking about?
Well, divorce, parental divorce, has numerous enduring effects on children and how they go about forming their own relationships and whether those marriages last. So people from divorced families are indeed more likely to get divorced, and that's been the case for a long time. But it's also important to note that the divorce rate between kids from intact and divorced families has narrowed over time. In other words, as divorce became more normal and more part of an accepted part of society, it seemed to have fewer adverse effects on kids.
Yes, the normalization of it, does that, you know, do you see that, Randy Cohen, in your work?
Yes. I mean, it certainly is. If you ask a child, do you know anyone else whose parents are divorced or divorcing? Kids often now say, oh, yeah, there are three kids in my class, or, mm-hmm. you know, where before there was a stigma, there was shame there. And now I don't think there's that. With the exception of families who come from strictly religious backgrounds where divorce is not an approved part of that, their religious practice. And so then there's lots of shame or guilt with that.
Nicholas Wiffinger, when we talk about the divorce cycle, are we just talking about the fact of how it happens over and over again? It tends to happen over again, or the likelihood that there'll be a divorce in the future?
Yes, we're just talking about how growing up in a divorced family affects the marital behavior of adult children.
And why does it make it more likely?
There's several reasons. One is that people from divorced families often marry much younger than other people, and people who marry very young have higher divorce rates. Another reason is that kids learn lessons about commitment. We'll take it for granted that all marriages will involve some conflict from now and then. Kids from divorced families are more likely to see that conflict as insurmountable. They're more likely to see that conflict as something their marriage can't survive. Having parents who stay married teaches kids something about commitment.
I think I like what you're saying, and I think also we have to teach our children how to struggle in an appropriate way. And I get concerned sometimes when I see the younger generation getting awards for showing up instead of, you know.
I see what you're saying, yeah.
You know. And
that's part of that whole thing.
Right. And I really do think that it's important that if parents are staying together just for the sake of the kids, that's not a message to stay married. I love, though, when parents explain to kids their struggle a little bit. If the kids see them arguing, they can see them also resolve it.
Hmm. Yes, but I should caution that while if your parents stay together, it sends a message about sticking with your own marriage. It's also true that parental conflict is terrible for kids.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I mean, I'm sure there's a piece of that that ends up in divorce as well, right, down the line? Or never marrying.
Well, that's not true.
Okay.
So, first of all, divorce rate has been in its longest sustained decline in human history. The divorce rate has been declining since 1980.
Okay.
The second thing is that the overall marriage rate, the chances that any one person will marry in his or her lifetime, that hasn't fallen that much. What has risen tremendously is how old we are when we get married. We're waiting longer than ever before. And so that means we spend less of our adult lives married. But the overall marriage rate hasn't fallen that much.
With collaborative, we have seen a lot more what we call gray divorces, long-term marriages of 30 years, 40 years. We had a divorce just recently of a 48-year marriage where they are getting divorced. It's really fascinating. I don't know what the statistics are. I just know what my experiences are in the cases that
interesting.
We've been.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That's absolutely right. Seniors, older people, are the only group for whom divorce rates have risen over the last 40 years. Right. Everyone else has fallen.
Mm-hmm. Ronald in Delaware, you're on the air. Hi, Ronald.
Hi, how are you? Hi, Randy. I worked with you about 5 or 6 years ago. I was on the board of the Collaborative Divorce Professionals for a couple of years.
So you're an attorney.
Yes, I'm actually just leaving a custody hearing I had in Delaware County, and I'm heading back to my office downtown in Franklin County. And I wanted to share a couple insights and thoughts I had while I had some of these professionals on the line.
Go ahead.
I think it's important that when you're dealing with high custody, high conflict cases, that irrespective of sort of the tone of the attorneys involved, that the parties really dictate the process. And if the parties have a level of communication, regardless of if the lawyers are battling, the parties control. And so if mother and father can put their differences aside, their personal differences, and agree that they don't want to spend their children's college tuition on expensive attorneys, oftentimes that leads to quick resolution and efficient litigation. And so what typically people don't understand, and what I'm seeing a lot in my practice in the last several years, is that parties think that the lawyers are the ones sort of being acrimonious and driving up the fees, but we are service providers, and we take our cues from our clients. And oftentimes, the most expensive and most contentious cases settle at the very end, when both parties realize that they're done fighting, paying lawyers, and that they get a cup of coffee together. As hard as it may be, as emotionally draining as that might be, they maybe discuss at a pickup or drop-off when the kids are busy, you know, have a conversation, talk to each other, and oftentimes that's what leads to resolution. So even the nastiest cases, there's always an opportunity for the mother and father or the husband and wife to sit down and have sort of an airing of grievances and discuss the case and how best to move forward. And I encourage my clients all the time to do that. They look at me like I'm crazy sometimes, but in reality, they're in control of their case. And if they want it to end and they don't want to pay exorbitant fees, they have to take control. Hmm.
So that's a great point. And it's a great push for collaborative, because it is, that's the whole point, is that the couples actually decide the outcome. The professionals are there to guide them in their decisions, but the couple, the parties, decide the outcome. And even if it's in the against the what the attorneys may think is, you know, the best whatever
deal,
right? Mm-hmm. If the parties agree, then that's what happens, and that's a very powerful thing. It totally stays out of the court, which I think is also a huge impetus for people to go this route, and it's very transparent, which means that it's really great for most couples. If there's lots of hidden money in offshore accounts, that probably isn't a good process.
<That's> but you know, yeah. Nicholas Wolfinger, what about the child's involvement in the process of divorce and including them in some of these decision making moments?
I don't know of research that looks specifically at that question, but I will say that anything that makes the process less acrimonious is good for the kids.
Mm-hmm.
Period.
And more transparent?
Good question. I don't know what the research says on that. I think it will never be fully transparent, just because the parents will have some reasons for calling it quits that will be hard for kids to understand.
Okay.
It's also important to note that some of the harm divorce does for kids concerns characteristics of the adults that were present long before the divorce was on the horizon. The kinds of people who are likely to get divorced are more likely to be acrimonious themselves, unsettled, less happy, and so those things all take a toll on the children involved.
Hmm. All right. Yeah.
I have regarding the children having a voice in this. I've had several cases where older kids, 14, 15, I had a 10-year-old with an older sibling, asked to meet with me and share with me their concerns about their parents, which was really a
how did that go?
Well, the first time it happened, I was like, but these children were all very insightful, more insightful than their parents gave them credit for. But in each of the cases, they were concerned because they thought that one of the parents, they saw that one of the parents as an underdog, and they were concerned that they didn't want to feel like they had to take care of that parent. And they could articulate that.
Wow.
And yeah, it was really powerful. And so we could work on some tools on things that they could do. And then in one of the cases, in all the cases, I asked if they were willing to sit with the parents with me and talk about it. In one of the cases, they were very willing. And one of the parents was not. But in the other cases, the parents really want to hear from their kids. And it's hard often, I think, for kids to have a voice unless there's a neutral person there who isn't part of it. Because kids don't want to hurt their parents' feelings.
Well, it makes me think about this. Is it, you know, Nicholas Wovinger, you know, chime in. I mean, Nicholas, do you think, all things being equal, that kids of divorce who have seen counselors, who had access to mental health care and, family counseling and that kind of a thing, do they do better?
Counseling certainly hurts, but note that there is a question.
You mean counseling certainly helps?
Yes, the kinds of people who are likely to see counselors are also the kinds of people who are more likely to be struggling with a divorce.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
Thus, it's hard to determine exactly whether counseling is benefiting or if the kids are having problems in the first place.
Right. Madeline in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Madeline.
Hi. I am going to shamelessly plug Al-Anon Alateen family groups. I grew up in a home where there was conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't say enough for folks who wish to stay together or wish to learn about some of the conflict going on in a home. Al-Anon Alateen Family Groups is everywhere. And I do believe the conflict, as one of the professionals said, the conflict was more worse than the drinking part.
Yeah.
But for those in a home where there is conflict, I realize I'm shamelessly plugging this program, but it really, I'm on my way into a meeting right now.
Okay.
And I've been married to a lovely man who is not an alcoholic for 38 years. My parents did stay together. It was tough. There was a lot of arguing, and that was the worst part. Mm-hmm. And I'll get off the other side.
All right.
Thank you.
Madeline, thanks a lot.
I think that's good advice. Everything is easier if you know your fellow, if you know other people are going through the same things.
Yeah.
So if there are support groups that can normalize the whole experience, I think that's fantastic.
Do you think there ought to be more support groups for kids of divorce?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Huh. Absolutely.
And there are.
Note that schools often function as de facto support groups for kids. Just because so many kids who have experienced divorce, they have a lot of peers who can normalize what they're going through.
Yeah. And the normalization, it's not automatic. Just because everybody knows somebody who's been divorced or who's from a divorced family, that's not enough then, Nicholas.
No, I mean, kids are going to talk, and that's going to normalize it.
Okay. And you're nodding.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think that kids need support, and if they're not going to, necessarily get that at home. I always applaud the parents who are willing to reach out to other people for support for their children and for themselves, because there are also adult support groups in different areas for divorces, people going through divorce.
Randy Cohen, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Randy Cohen is a mental health counselor and a collaborative divorce neutral. And once again, she's been on the program before to talk about collaborative marriage. We'll have a link to that program on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. And Nicholas Wovinger, professor of family and consumer studies at the University of Utah, thank you so much for joining us today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks to the All Sides staff, our producer, Mary Lee Williams, our assistant producer, Kyle McKinnon, our interns, Martin Coleman, Alexander Havolchik, Scott Good, and Ray Brewster, with video production by Rich Blue and Amber Blue. Alan DeCenzo is a composer of our theme music, WOSU News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson, Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrilla, and Senior Broadcast Technician Eric French. Be sure to like All Sides on Facebook, follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides, and you can follow me too at Ann Fisher, WOSU. Thanks again for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.